Matters of Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.
Well, hello and welcome to another episode of Matters of Life and Death. As always, I'm Tim White and I'm joined by my dad, John White. Hi, Dad.
Hi, Tim.
And it's a bit of a two-parter today, picking up on one news story and one scientific study. The first news story is kind of returning to a thing that we've been talking about a fair bit on the podcast in the last year or two, which is reining in social media companies, particularly the large American Silicon Valley tech firms. And we've talked in the past about a series of court cases that some of these companies, and most notably Google and Meta, which owns Facebook and Instagram and WhatsApp, have been facing. And there's been a really interesting news line this week, which is that Meta has settled one of these massive court cases in the US. So dozens of states, of attorney generals from the different states in America, had joined forces to sue Meta. Again, that's the company that runs Facebook and Instagram, claiming that their social media platforms were harming children, but they were addictive and harmful. And there was a lot of anticipation ahead of this trial. People were looking for Mark Zuckerberg to go on the stand, and clearly the states had dug up a lot of damning kind of internal emails. I think there was a whistleblower involved. And to forestall all of that at the last minute, Meta has settled this out of court and has agreed to pay $18 billion to most of the states in the US, as well as a series of tweaks and changes to how children experience Facebook and Instagram to try and appease the concerns.
Yeah, I think there's quite a lot of a disappointment, really, that I think many people who felt they'd been personally harmed or by the Meta products, Facebook and so on, were looking forward to seeing the Meta executives like Mark Zuckerberg and others being directly confronted in court and having everything openly debated in open court and recorded and so on. And therefore, to have all that suddenly the rug pulled under them, because I think Meta took a decision that the best way of limiting the PR damage was just to settle out of court. And I think, therefore, it's understandable that a lot of people will feel rather aggrieved.
Mm. And while $18 billion sounds like an absolutely astronomical sum, Meta's revenue in 2025 was $200 billion. So, you know, it's not nothing to Meta, but it's not a particularly deterring sum of money they've agreed to pay. And it is certainly much less than if they'd taken this to a full trial. Who knows what the judge and jury might have ended up imposing on them in costs if they'd lost the case. So clearly the company decided not to roll the dice and to agree a settlement which was, you know, painful but ultimately quite affordable for such a wealthy company.
And cynically, you know, could be seen as just part of the cost of doing business. So I think at one level it's a pity that that the full information hasn't been discussed in open court. I suppose the other side of the coin is that once a case like this comes as a precedent, there will be large incentives of other people to put forward similar claims.
But all that said, we shouldn't, you know, dismiss this too much, because it's not just, they haven't just kind of stuffed the state's mouths with gold and told them to go away with $18 billion. They've agreed to make a series of quite significant changes to how teenagers experience Facebook, Instagram, WhatsApp. So that's things like a night mode, which will automatically block notifications between midnight and 6 a.m., a default two-hour daily time limit. So across Instagram and Facebook, you can't, if you're a teenager, you can't spend more than 2 hours on those apps. And you can't turn that setting off without your parents' permission. They're going to hide the like button on teens' profiles. This is about fears that, you know, the kind of dopamine hit of getting likes kind of hooks people into this addictive cycle of trying to pursue more, spend more and more time on the apps. A school mode, so there's no notifications between 8 a.m. and 3 o'clock on school days. Prompts telling the teenager when they've done 15 minutes, 60 minutes, 90 minutes. You can choose a non-algorithmic feed, turning off autoplay, blah, 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 blah. Like, these are tangible wins for those who say that social media is harmful, to particularly to teenagers. And these are some of the tweaks that kind of regulators and activists have been calling for years.
Yeah, that's true. Although, as far as I know, they only apply in the USA, I think, initially, and therefore, you know, the rest of the world battles with the problems as before, and. One can imagine that teenagers won't be too impressed by having a naughty version of Facebook rather than the full fat adult version, and will be trying techniques to circumvent.
And it obviously falls far short of what the UK government, the Australian government, and numerous other governments are pursuing, which is a full bore 24/7 ban on under 16-year-olds using any kind of social media. Though, as we've discussed, Australia, the kind of trailblazer here, has found it harder than they expected to actually kick all these teenagers who already had accounts off the platform. And we will see if the UK's ban goes ahead, you know, whether they're any more successful. I think certainly you're right that these measures only affect their users in America, but clearly it sets a precedent, and you'd imagine kind of digital regulators across the rest of the world are going to be very quickly demanding that Meta implement exactly the same kind of suite of restrictions on teenagers in their own jurisdictions, or face potentially a full blackout.
Yeah, and I think, you know, as we've talked before, I think this does reflect a real change in the tide, the way that the tide is running on social media. And the analogy with tobacco, it's interesting, is frequently emerges now in the reporting. So I think this this historical comparison with the tobacco companies, it'll be interesting to see whether the reputation of Meta and the other social media companies is really held in such in the same way as tobacco companies.
And there's another resonance, which is that there was actually a very famous court case, which is exactly the same, was brought by a series of state attorney generals against the tobacco manufacturers. And this, in this case, they were demanding kind of recompense for the decades of public health disaster and, you know, cancer and all the other things that tobacco causes, which, again, the tobacco companies had known about for decades and had covered up in a not dissimilar way to what some of the tech firms have done. And so that was actually the kind of the first method of really beginning to restrict tobacco companies and start to, which, as we've known, has ramped up and up until, you know, we have some companies, some countries today, like the UK, has actually got a legal ban on smoking for anyone under the age of about 14 will never be allowed to smoke. So you could say this is kind of mimicking the tactics, that the public health tactics, you know, seeing this as a public health issue rather than a kind of nerdy, wonky kind of tech policy issue. There was the other case, wasn't there, in New Mexico, where a federal judge handed down a ruling against Meta, which under a local state law in New Mexico about public companies that cause a public nuisance, that was originally to do with firms, you know, belching out fumes from factories and that kind of thing. But they very kind of cleverly bent the law to argue that Meta's products were a public nuisance. And they got fines of worth, I think it was about $1 billion just in one state alone. So there's a kind of, as you say, I think the tide is definitely turning and people are starting to see this as less a kind of techie battle and more a kind of public health, the people versus the big business.
Yes, and it's we've mentioned previously that it's one of the ways in which the law courts, and particularly tort law, where people are being sued for damages, is one of the final refuges when it seems that states themselves are powerless to control massive business interests. It's ultimately the ability of individual citizens and states indeed to sue companies which act as a restraining force. It's interesting, isn't it, that in authoritarian countries such as China, it's completely different. The rule of the state is absolutely unchallenged. It's the state that decides what companies can do. And it is interesting that in general, the state control of social media, certainly within China, is much more draconian. What you're yes. allowed to do within China is very limited. Mm. I mean, the state's much less concerned what the Chinese companies are doing outside of China.
Absolutely. Yes. I think, for example, so TikTok, famously a Chinese company, has a kind of Chinese version of its app, and it's already much more restricted for Chinese teenagers than TikTok, the same app, but the kind of Western-facing version is for Westerners. I mean, there's an interesting line I really jumped out to me when I was reading a Guardian article about this Meta settlement, which said, "For the US, settlement is a victory. A jury has done what the US Congress could not, put controls on a powerful tech company," which really underlines the point you're making that, you know, normally we expect regulation and restrictions on harmful companies to kind of flow from the government, from the Congress, from the president, but they have shown no ability or no desire to rein in effectively these Silicon Valley kind of behemoths. And so it's turned to these individual court cases, these juries and judges in places all over the states that are proving to be more effective than many people thought it would in kind of curbing the excesses of Silicon Valley.
And so I suppose from a Christian point of view, it's why we should give thanks for the rule of law. You know, the rule of law is a very important principle of justice, of holding people to account, particularly, you know, from a Christian point of view, where there's so much focus on concern for the underpowered, the widows, the orphans, the aliens, the individuals who have no power and who need protection. It's the rule of law which provides a kind of institutionalized protection for the most vulnerable.
Mm. And I think you see one of the most, as you say, most profound and like powerful ideas that Western civilization has come up with is this idea that all stand equal before the law. Everyone from the king down to the lowliest peasant must answer to exactly the same statutes. And if found guilty, their wealth and their status and their privilege is no protection. Now, obviously, as we all know, that idea is great in theory and more complex to work out in practice. But I would argue it's a really profoundly Christian principle that actually the fact that Mark Zuckerberg is one of the richest people on earth is no protection. If he breaks the law and causes harm, he should be treated by a judge and jury exactly the same as if he was a homeless person off the street in San Francisco, rather than living in a gated commune somewhere counting his many billions. I mean, you even go back to that bit, that parable Jesus tells about the unjust judge, you know, and about how the widow comes seeking justice and the clear, I mean, it's a complex parable, but I think one of the clear things you can draw from it is that God does not want our justice systems to show partiality to the rich and powerful and be biased against the weak and the poor.
Yeah, and that's a frequent theme in the Old Testament of the Old Testament prophets, isn't it? Holding kings and judges to account for corruption and bribery and so on. Mm. I suppose just a final thought on this story, and that is that this is concerning social media, but the very same companies are heavily involved in the development of AI and the release of very powerful AI tools to the general public. And we're already starting to see a whole litany of problems and disasters which AI tools have caused in apparently with individuals. So I suspect that this will be seen as a kind of model for similar cases involving AI. And it's the same thing, that if at the moment the state seems to be pretty powerless in reining in the AI companies, and it may well again turn out it's the law courts which are the main force that will prevent massive abuse.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's probably true. You've had those kind of sporadic, fairly weak kind of concords and pacts, haven't you, where some companies have got together or some countries got together and say, yes, we're going to agree that AI should only do nice things and not do bad things, but it's got no teeth, it's got no enforcement ability. Fundamentally, the only thing that an open AI or an Anthropic is going to respond to is going to be the force of law, the threat of massive fines or prison terms for its senior executives. That's actually going to, I suspect, work to curb or kind of reshape their efforts towards the public good.
Yeah, you know, one of the deeply dispiriting things is if you look at the amount of money that these large tech companies spend in lobbying, including Meta, they are far and ahead of any other commercial enterprise. Massive sums spent in lobbying, both in Washington, D.C., and also, interestingly, in the European Parliament in Strasbourg is one of the main targets. They've sort of... regulatory capture is one of the terms that is used. They just by sheer amount of wealth, and it's deeply corrupt. But I'm afraid it's well recognised.
Yeah. Yes, we'll have to watch that space. But I think it's a good news story overall for those of us who are convinced that excessive social media is not good news for young people, and probably not good news for us adults as well. But that's a different story.
Listening to Matters of Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.
So our second story is all about an interesting scientific study that you found, Dad. Tell us about what it is.
Yeah, this is a recently published paper in the very respected journal Nature Human Behavior. It comes from a group, well-known group of medical ethicists based in Oxford. And it was about public perceptions of genetic testing of embryos in vitro fertilization. So as people are probably well aware, in vitro fertilization, an embryo is created in the laboratory. A number of embryos are created, and they're then routinely tested for a range of genetic conditions. But in the UK and in Europe, the procedure is that only a small group of very serious medical conditions like sickle cell anemia or other chromosomal abnormalities are tested for. But what is now becoming available is the possibility of so-called polygenic testing, where a whole series of genes are examined for and entered into a large computerized predictive AI system, which then will calculate the risk of an embryo developing non-medical conditions. And the non-medical conditions which were tested for in this study was, in particular, low IQ and antisocial behaviour.
So just to be really clear, what we're saying is kind of traditionally what you would test embryos for once they've been created in the lab before they are implanted back into the mother's womb would be really kind of crystal clear things. So maybe Down syndrome, where you either have the particular genetic abnormality or you don't, it's black or white, serious medical disabilities and issues. Whereas the polygenic screening is saying we're going to try and look at a huge array of different, what particular cocktail, you know, of the billions of varieties of human genomes you could have, this cocktail, and then run it through some predictive software that gives you a percentage chance of developing certain traits. And I mean, my eyebrows were raised at mentions of antisocial behaviour. Can we really make any meaningful prediction about what an embryo is going to grow up to be antisocial based on what their genes are?
Well, in fact, large genetic studies have shown that genetics influences a huge amount of behaviour later on in life. Believe it or not, your political affiliation turns out to have some genetic associations. As well as things like IQ behavior, antisocial behavior, criminality, and so on. Now, none of these associations are 100%. We're talking just about an increase above average, above the population risk as a whole. But nonetheless,
This is now technically feasible. And so the question is, yes, we can do this, but ought we be doing this in in vitro fertilization?
And the kind of presumption, I think, from the kind of medical establishment, the researchers who have been pushing the boundary on this kind of testing has long been, at least maybe in Europe and the UK, that while it is all good and all good gravy to let's go and find out all those rare conditions and tell people in advance so we can weed out the embryos in IVF that will develop rare abnormalities and disabilities, trying to find out what hair color your embryo might have, how tall they're going to be, if they're going to be good at music, if they're going to be antisocial, is not what parents are looking for. And the intuition has been that the everyday public, people who are actually using IVF, are not interested in designer babies, in inverted commas.
Yes. Now, it's important to recognise, of course, that there are ethical issues even with the screening for Down syndrome or heart disease or whatever. You know, that this raises a whole series of very significant and troubling questions about eugenics and all the rest. Nonetheless, in general, there's been very strong public support for these kind of screening techniques, both screening of embryos but also screening of unborn babies at an early stage of the pregnancy. But as you say, in general, previous studies have shown that most people in our society are really rather concerned about so-called designer babies and how this technology might be abused.
And even the language of designer babies, I think that was originally coined by some kind of tabloid journalese as a kind of smear label for this kind of modern day eugenics, on the presumption that no one actually wants to design their babies. People don't think parenthood should be entered into in that way. But actually what this survey found, both of people in China and the US, two very different cultures with very different kind of ethical backgrounds, was that people were much more open to choosing non-medical traits. So this is things like low IQ and antisocial behaviour in their prospective embryos.
Yes, and so what the study showed, first of all, is that both in China and in the USA, over 50%, in fact around 61% overall of those who were approached were in favour of polygenic screening of embryos, and in fact, if you asked the numbers who thought it was straightforwardly immoral or morally wrong, or whether it should be legally banned, only 18% or less than one in five felt that it was definitely immoral or should be banned.
So actually, despite this practice not really being, am I right in saying not really being legally possible, at least in the UK, that's not something you can currently do if you're doing IVF, most people, quite a small number of people actually think it should be prohibited by law.
Well, in the UK has very strict laws on in vitro fertilisation. It's all governed by the Human Fertilisation and Embryology Authority, and in fact it's a criminal offence for laboratories to step outside the guidelines. So certainly in the UK it hasn't been and isn't being carried out. In the USA, it depends very much on individual states, and many states have very limited, if any, regulations on what happens to embryos. And so polygenic screening is already happening. In fact, we covered some weeks ago.
Pick Your Baby, I think it was called.
PickYourBaby.com, yes. And that was chilling. In New York. So clearly, in some states, this is legal and is being commercially put forward. Anyway, in this particular study, they took four conditions, which were heart disease, visual impairment, low IQ, and antisocial behaviour. And they found that participants were in favour of using genetic screening in trying to prevent babies being born with all of these conditions. And in the USA, it was heart disease that was the highest, the one that most people felt one we should try to screen against. But after that came antisocial behaviour and then low IQ. Interestingly, in China, it was avoidance of low IQ and antisocial behaviour was virtually equal to heart disease. It was, again, was seen as something that was really unacceptable.
I'm a kind of COD cultural theorist, would say something sage about East Asian societies' love of conformity and the kind of communist states' crackdown on antisocial behaviour, potentially shifting opinions there rather than the American frontier individualist spirit. But perhaps beyond the scope of this conversation. But what was fascinating about this study was they didn't just ask people hypotheticals, did they, about, you know, what, do you think it is morally acceptable to test for these non-medical conditions? They then tested out people's stated preferences by putting them into this imagined scenario where they had actual embryos in front of them with certain risk scores and said, would you implant this one or that one?
That's right. And they found that in both the US and Chinese groups, participants avoided embryos with above average chances of undesirable non-medical traits. And this avoidance was at least as strong as avoidance of adverse medical conditions. So it's interesting as a sort of human psychology that there's sometimes rather a difference between what you would say in general, I don't think this is right, I don't think you should do that, what the decision you make when you're confronted directly with a choice which is going to affect you personally. And you know, if you put yourself in that situation, you would say, well, fundamentally I'm not very much in favor of this, but now you've given me the choice, now you've given me this information, am I going to be principled and say I'm not going to take it into account, it's irrelevant to me whether this child is going has a risk of being antisocial, or you're saying, you know what, now you've given me this information, I think I am going to take it into account.
Yes. We've talked about this before, haven't we? Almost like the tyranny of too much knowledge, too much power. We talked about this in different kinds of testing of embryos and things like that. That, as you say, it's all very well having high-minded ideals about what you think human beings should and shouldn't know about their future children. But actually, hold a gun to your head, a lot of parents, it turns out, actually would quite like, you know, given the choice, to have a less antisocial child rather than a more antisocial child.
Well, at one level, can you blame them?
Or you tell me, Dad.
If I'd known.
If you'd only existed in the 90s.
Sadly, the technology wasn't quite there yet.
Yeah.
So I think this is, I mean, we've talked about it before. I found a helpful distinction between the two aspects of parental love. Part of it, which is a accepting kind of love, and part of which is a forming kind of love. And what tends to happen is that the formation love in modern society has so dominated parental thinking that it starts right from the embryo. I am going to choose and form and make this child into the one that matches my thoughts. Whereas traditionally, a large amount of parenthood has been this idea that you accept the child that you've been given, however much you wish it could have been otherwise.
Yeah, and as we said many times before, it all comes down to, do you see children as a gift primarily or as a product? Are they something you receive, we would say, from God, or are they something that you generate, you create, you build yourself? I guess even the framing of that, you can see where I think, and I think the Christian tradition points us more firmly towards the idea of receiving children as a gift rather than seeking to tweak them and to mould them and shape them and build them. But actually, it turns out in our kind of post-Christian Western world, and indeed in the a-Christian Chinese context, people are quite open to seeing children as something that they should be able to construct, change, edit, form themselves.
And so the wider question is, how much does it matter what the population as a whole think about this? There is a whole view of ethics which says, you know, ethics is basically a empirical discipline. You just get thousands of people together, you ask them the question, then you go with whatever the views are the majority.
The wisdom of crowds.
And therefore, and certainly in democratic societies, if there's a strong majority of the population in favour of a particular ethical course of action, or in terms of changing the laws. It's often very difficult, however strongly medics or elite groups think, no, this is not a good idea. It can be extremely problematic and even politically unacceptable to oppose the wishes of the majority.
Mm. The classic example people come up with when talking about kind of populism versus elitism and ethics would be something like the death penalty, which in the UK has been abolished for, you know, generations since the 1960s, I think it was, the final people were executed. And yet, you know, occasionally you do find polls where the number in favour of execution of death penalty is tips over 50%. And yet there is a kind of total prohibition on even raising the idea in Parliament. You know, you would get jeered at any party, even the most, you know, even in the Conservative Party, the right-wing party, there is just no prospect of that party ever adopting the return of the death penalty. So that you could point to as a clear example, a pressing, consistent example where kind of elite opinion formers in Parliament, in academia, in the law courts, have decided we know better than Joe Public, and the ordinary British yokel might want to bring back hanging, but we're not going to let them. We're going to say, actually, there is a bigger ethical call here, and we believe this is just wrong in all circumstances, and we're not even going to open the question.
Yeah, no, I think that's a very interesting example. And as you say, that's been the case for decades. And the defence, of course, is not that, well, of course, we're the elite and we know better. The defence is that actually all the empirical evidence shows that execution, the death penalty, doesn't reduce crime rates. And, of course, you have these horrific miscarriages of justice.
Yes.
And the impossibility of any kind of restitution, which doesn't apply to all other forms of imprisonment and so on.
Which I guess underlines that we all, or a lot of us, take for granted that actually ethics is not a democratic pursuit. That it doesn't matter, that it's actually a pursuit of truth and of reason and of rationality, and that something can be true even if most people don't agree with it. It remains true. And in this instance, it remains true, and I accept this truth, that the death penalty is not a healthy way for society to deal with its criminal justice problem for all the reasons you state. And that would remain true even if our society was 100% in favour of hanging criminals.
Yeah, I mean, that's true. It's just much harder to get empirical evidence on this kind of topic we're talking about, embryo selection. I mean, in theory, you could do a study over 20 years of one state which allowed polygenic screening and another country which didn't, and then you look at the way attitudes towards children and you say, you know, are children in one country better respected and cared for than in the other? I mean, of course, there are so many variables, and in reality, therefore, in most ethical issues, you're not going to get that kind of empirical evidence. And in the end, it does depend on your vision of what is right, or some branch of philosophers would say it's a question of what is the good. You know, what is the good for parenting? What is the good for society? In what does the good look like in the relationships between parents and children? Mm.
And I think the reason ethics persists as a kind of philosophical discipline is because most ethical questions cannot be answered definitively in a black and white yes or no. It's just a question of accumulating evidence. It's not a science, it's an art, I would argue. And I think attempts to turn ethics, you know, through systems like utilitarianism always run into the ground, because actually seeking the good and discerning the good in situation by situation can't be reduced to a kind of formula, an equation, a set of hypotheses that you test against evidence like that.
And so I think I would want to say the question comes to what would a good society look like? And sometimes, you know, in these kind of discussions and debates, I've tried to paint a contrast between two visions of society. You know, in society A, child selection is very much a rational basis, which all parents are involved in. And as a result, we've managed to eradicate significant number of diseases and behavioural problems, and then Society B is a society which welcomes all children and which regards them all as being of value and benefit and celebrates their lives irrespective of their abilities and their behaviour and so on. Which would be a better society? Which society would you prefer to belong to?
Mm. Yeah, I think that is quite compelling. I guess the counter argument would be, in practice, though no one talks about it in these terms, Western societies, the UK, the US, they do already practice a kind of crude version of this through selective abortion, and so we are already a society which has decided that some babies are lives are not worth living, and some babies are, and some diseases and conditions and differences we don't want to exist. Hands up, people would say they're quite happy with the society that 50 years of that policy, spoken or unspoken, has produced. So why shouldn't we lean into more of that, but just do it at a more precise genetic level and wind the clock back and do it when the embryo is only but a few days old?
And though ultimately, again, it comes back to our fundamental commitments, doesn't it, as to how we view human life intrinsically, whether it has an intrinsic value, and we're always going to live in a pluralistic society. I think we're always going to live in societies where there are fundamental disagreements about these absolutely crucial beliefs of the value of human life. So the sociological question and the legal question, the political question, is how do we live together in a society? How do we ensure social harmony and a strong community when we do have very fundamental differences about the value of human life?
Mm. A really pressing example of this debate and the kind of question of that elite gatekeepers withholding from the public would be a topic that we've discussed on this podcast before, which is about assisted dying. And that would be another example where, you know, a lot of polls, a lot of surveys, obviously the devil's in the details about how you word it, but, you know, it's not difficult to write a poll which will give you quite a large majority of people in favour of some form of euthanasia or physician-assisted suicide, however you want to call it. And yet, many cultures, many jurisdictions, including England and Wales at present, though, you know, it's obviously up for debate, have resisted that. And I would say, as a Christian, as a believer, I'm grateful. I mean, we had this conversation, didn't we, about last year about the House of Lords and to what extent it was a good or bad thing to kind of push the parliamentary procedure to the absolute limit to try and block a law that came passed by the democratically elected House of Commons, and whether there is a greater good there. And, you know, Christians can disagree on that, but I actually think, you know, I come back to the idea, ethics is not a democracy, and just because a lot of people agree with it doesn't mean that it's right. And I'm grateful to live in a society where we don't just have mob rule, where as soon as you can get 50% plus one, that thing becomes law, irrespective of how good or bad it might make our society as a consequence.
Yes, I agree. And in fact, although there are, of course, very strong philosophical and spiritual reasons why intentional killing is not a good way for the medical profession to go, the strongest arguments in the political arena against the legalization of assisted suicide has been the protection of the vulnerable. Mm. And that's an argument which resonates with a lot of people in our society.
Yes.
And I think the same will be true about the introduction of widespread genetic screening and so on. Is the question of what would the implications be, the wider implications, for the most vulnerable children? I mean, one of the things that I've noticed is that because prenatal screening is now so widely practiced in pregnancy, when a baby is born with some congenital malformation, which was, quote, missed in the screening process, parents' response is often a kind of outrage. You know, I thought that's what all the tests were for. You know, how
you've betrayed me.
Yes, exactly, as though there was a kind of implicit contract between parents and the medical authorities that provided you do all the right things and have all the tests we recommend, we guarantee to provide you with a perfect child. And of course, that's not the way
it don't work like that.
So, anyway. I think perhaps we should bring this discussion to an end.
But I just think, Odd, as a final question on that, you know, a large part of this, and again, the assisted dying example is instructive here, is a lot of those legislators who have kind of dug their heels in and are frustrated the passage of it are people who would very much say, we are speaking up on behalf of vulnerable communities, whether that is those with dementia, those in care homes, those with chronic conditions, those with disabilities who can't speak for themselves. And it's all very well for our mostly fit, able, young, working population House of Commons to vote through something in theory, but have we actually thought about the consequences for those who aren't represented? And there's another group who haven't been polled about embryo testing, and that would be the embryos themselves, right? You know, well, are we so confident if we included them in the sample, people would still, as a society, be so much in favour of this technology and this pushing the boundaries of what we can and can't test for? And that's not just hypothetical, because we know there are numerous examples of people who have grown up with conditions such as Down syndrome, who I know, because they tell us, are profoundly offended and upset, and even going on far as to fight court cases arguing on the illegality of the fact that they are open to be terminated or maybe potentially screened out before they're even implanted, whereas their non-disabled fellow citizens are not. So again, this question of, if we're going to do ethics by democracy, let's make sure we're asking everyone's opinion, not just some people's opinion.
Yeah, it's a very good point. And in fact, there's a fascinating collection of accounts by people who were created by in vitro fertilization, including things like sperm and egg donation, who talk about their own struggles with discovering that they have large numbers of half siblings, or the decisions that were taken, and the overwhelming attitude that comes across is, I'm very grateful to be alive, I'm very grateful that I'm here, but my parents, the people who brought me into existence, were only thinking of their own needs to create a child, and they weren't thinking at all about what the implications might be for the child that they created.
Very interesting. All right, well, let's draw it to a close there. Thanks for listening, everyone. As ever, we'd love to know your own thoughts. Do you disagree with what we've been talking about? Have we forgotten something or missed something? But also, have you got suggestions for other scientific studies we could look at and respond to? Other new developments in technology, in culture, in ethics, in healthcare and beyond that we should talk about on this podcast that we haven't yet? Please do get in touch by emailing us molad, M-O-L-A-D, at premier.org.uk. And as always, there's plenty of resources on Dad's website. That's johnwyatt.com. Do have a look at that. Lots of things to read and listen to and watch on these topics. And you can find some of my writing and journalism on my website, tswyatt.com. Thanks for listening, everyone. We'll be back next week with another episode. But until then, bye-bye.
You've been listening to Matters of Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.